Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long call-in show devoted to discussion of the health and welfare of animals. My name is Dana Hill, and I'm happy to welcome back to the program once again our very good friend, Dr. Michael Scher. And we're going to discuss a variety of animal emergencies and many other topics. We'll welcome your phone calls as well. 352-392-8989 is the number. We'll be back with Animal Airwaves Live after this news from NPR in Washington.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Senate has voted to approve a Democratic spending plan that would raise $1 trillion in taxes and cut spending by an equal amount. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, this came at the end of a marathon voting session.
It's called a vote-a-rama, and senators are allowed to offer an unlimited number of amendments. About 5 hours into the lightning round-style voting, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid had a message for his fellow senators, who in total had filed nearly 600 amendments.
Senators are going to have to understand this is not going to go on forever.
Not forever, but the voting did last until almost 5 in the morning. Ultimately, senators voted on some 70 amendments, a record. It's worth noting they're all non-binding, so the votes were symbolic, potential fodder for campaigns in 2014. The vote for passage on the budget was close, 50-49, with 4 red state Democrats voting against their party's spending plan. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
President Obama wrapped up his brief trip to the Middle East by visiting a historical site in Jordan today. During his visit, he met with King Abdullah and discussed the issue of the swelling numbers of refugees fleeing the Syrian civil war. They're crossing the border into Jordan and other countries. Obama says he'll work to send Jordan additional humanitarian aid. France is scaling back its Tax the Rich plan amid overwhelming opposition. As NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports, the massive proposed levy has been deemed unconstitutional.
France's highest court has already thrown out the 75% tax rate, and now a high-level advisory council agrees. Under the decision, the rate on incomes above 1 million euros, or $1.3 million, cannot exceed 60%. French President François Hollande campaigned on a promise to impose a 75% tax on the super wealthy, despite criticism that it would do little to solve growing fiscal problems and would drive away the wealthiest citizens. Film star Gérard Depardieu embarrassed the government when he picked up and moved to Belgium to avoid the new tax. The current top tax rate in France is 41%. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Lawmakers in Cyprus are working hastily on a package that could avert their country's bankruptcy. The lawmakers rejected a pact earlier this week to pay for a European bailout. It was very unpopular. It would have taken up to 10% of the money out of people's bank accounts. Cypriot lawmakers have to come up with another plan, and it will be expensive. They need to find billions of dollars to qualify for billions of euros in rescue loans. New Pope Francis paid a visit to his predecessor, Pope Emeritus Benedict, today. The men lunched together and had a private talk at the papal summer residence south of Rome. Benedict has gone into retirement there since resigning the papacy. As the men went to pray together, Benedict offered Francis the traditional kneeler used by a pope. Francis refused and insisted the men pray side by side. This is NPR. Aircraft maker Boeing says it will lay off 800 workers by the end of this year. The pink slips will all come in Washington state. Boeing will get rid of another 1,200 to 1,500 jobs through attrition. The company says two of its jets do not need as many workers on the line. Boeing told the Seattle Times that cuts are not related to recent problems with its 787 or Dreamliner jet. One coal miner is dead and another has been injured in a mine collapse in Utah. NPR's Howard Burkitts reports the incident is the latest in a series of coal mine deaths that has federal regulators concerned.
28-year-old Elam Jones was one of the rescuers 5 years ago when 9 people were killed at Utah's Crandall Canyon mine. Just down the road Friday, Jones became the victim. Rock peeled away from the roof in a Rhino Resource Partners mine near Huntington, Utah, a town grieving again. Jones died, his mining partner survived. The mine has a better-than-average injury rate, but was recently cited for 11 safety violations. The Mine Safety and Health Administration reported record-low fatality rates nationwide last year, but has issued an alert given 8 deaths so far this year. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
The United Nations warns in less than 20 years, half the people in the world could be facing a scarcity of water. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is kicking off the International Year of Water Cooperation with a warning. He says competition's growing between rural and urban areas. The UN says as more people move to cities, water use is expected to increase by half in the year 2025. The majority of people on the planet will live in areas that face water scarcity. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Programming sponsored by Daytime Dogs and Friends, specializing in private dog walking, dog adventures, in-home pet sitting, and overnight stays for dogs, cats, birds, and more. Planning a vacation, a business trip, or a long day at the office, Daytime Dogs and Friends provides pet care services customized to each client's needs, serving the Gainesville and surrounding area. Daytime Dogs and Friends is locally owned and operated, fully insured and bonded. Learn more at www.daytimedogs.com or 352-219-4246.
The 2013 Great American Cleanup will take place at Westside Park in Gainesville on Saturday, April 6th, beginning at 8 a.m. Volunteers will remove graffiti, pick up litter, and complete gardening projects in Alachua County. There will be prizes, food, and refreshments, and a post-cleanup party. More information is available at kacb.org.
Supported by Wild Birds Unlimited, celebrating 10 years of business and supporting local public radio in Gainesville. Wild Birds Unlimited is in its new location just down the sidewalk from the Fresh Market at 4212 Northwest 16th Boulevard. Online at gainesville.wbu.com.
Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFTFM. This is our weekly, hour-long call-in show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. My name is Dana Hill, and I'm happy to welcome back to the program our very good friend, Dr. Michael Scher from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. And we're going to talk today about all manner of veterinary emergencies and just about any other animal topic that you could think of, really. Dr. Scher has had a wonderful and long career in veterinary medicine. And what we have learned over our many talks together is that he's pretty able to answer just about any question you guys can come up with about your pets. So we welcome your phone calls, area code 352-392-8989. Dr. Scher, thank you so much for coming back to the program. People may know and remember that you were the first guest on this program. I was very grateful back then, and I'm very grateful for you coming back here and visiting with us again so regularly. It's a pleasure, really, to have you here.
Well, thank you, Dane. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about today, I'm thinking about something that probably comes up for people who have dogs especially and cats too that live outside. It's a pretty stormy day in much of our listening area today. And what kind of risks do our pets face if they can't get indoors during a stormy day?
Well, all species, let me say great and small, are susceptible to lightning strikes. Which is something you do worry about a lot in this part of the world. And the large animals especially are the ones who are more targeted out in the fields, cattle, horses especially. The dogs and cats escape being hit by lightning most of the time. I have yet to see a case of it. But the large animal practitioners see their fair share. Mm-hmm. So what you worry about as far as your pet is concerned is to, A, don't take the risk. Try to get them indoors in a protected environment during a bad storm. Besides lightning strike, you have to worry about fallen trees or other objects from wind turbulence that can victimize them as well. Or the animals crossing a street and getting hit by a car because the car can't stop safely enough because of the wet pavement. So there are a lot of indirect as well as direct consequences that adverse weather conditions bring.
I have a few, more than a few really, neighborhood cats that I see in my yard and in the neighbors' yards. And These are animals that I assume don't live inside anybody's house. Mm-hmm. I see them outdoors all the time. And I often wonder, well, gosh, what are they doing during the storms? They must be going somewhere because I don't see them. Now, sometimes I'll open up the back door during a rainstorm and there's a kitty trying to just, you know, take cover. And then that's, you know, totally good. I'm happy to provide whatever shelter I can. And, you know, they go under the shed. They go, you know, somewhere behind the garbage cans or something.
And, under cars.
Yeah. And they find places. Yeah. But as you're saying, animals out in the field, cattle, horses,
right.
There's no ready escape for them. And, you know, that's a risky place to be in thunderstorms.
Those are the ones who become victimized most of the time, especially if they're under trees or other targets of lightning where the lightning will strike and they'll be in the flow of the current as it travels down the tree to the surrounding area, and that's where they might be standing.
Mm. You know, summer is on its way. We are now officially in spring, and people are going out now more and more and enjoying, well, maybe not so much today, but are enjoying the outdoors and are going to be. And we've spoken before about this, but it's a pretty good area to cover again. The potential risks of being out with your pet, especially your dog, if you're going out for a walk, you can face a number of potentially dangerous situations. We've talked a bit about snake bites, and we'll probably get to that again. But insect bites is one I hadn't really thought about so much before. And certainly I'm aware that some human beings are allergic, dangerously so, to something like a bee sting or whatever. Can this happen with our pets?
Absolutely. There's a classification of certain insects. They're actually called venomous hymenoptera, which will include the wasp, the hornet, the bee, the yellow jackets, and the fire ants. Fire ants don't fly, of course, but they do contain a venom that can cause both immediate and delayed type of allergic reactions, some of which can be life-threatening. And there are some animal deaths that do occur, especially if they're swarmed by a nest of angry bees or yellow jackets, for instance. Puppies and kittens who cannot move quickly might be swarmed by fire ants. The lesions from those are characteristically on their belly. We do see this in our emergency clinic periodically.
Animals are curious. Dogs go nosing around and things. Cats do too. So, you know, in their adventures, they may come in contact with some sort of stinging insects. Mm-hmm. And particularly if they encounter a hive, right, or a nest.
Right.
This would be problematic.
Very, very problematic for anybody, man or animal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you get attacked by 100 bees, there's a chance that you might die before you even get to medical care.
So if your animal gets in this situation, what do you recommend?
Well, first thing you do is call your emergency clinic, or if you can't do that, get them to an emergency clinic, because there might be medications available to treat for instance, anaphylaxis, which is the acute allergic response. But the pet owner has to be careful that they themselves don't endanger their lives. So if there's a way that they can grab the animal and run safely without endangering themselves, go for it. And usually if you're within 15 to 20 minutes of a veterinary facility, we should be able to save most of those animals.
Is there some sort of anti-venom, or what is administered to pets in that circumstance?
The same thing that they would do to treat humans if they came in with an acute allergic reaction from a bee sting or a wasp. they would receive something like Benadryl or diphenhydramine, which is an antihistamine.
I see.
In the most severe cases, they would use epinephrine.
Mm-hmm.
And then glucocorticoids or steroid drugs are sometimes used for the delayed reactions that can occur afterward.
Because should an animal experience this sort of allergic reaction, probably much like a human being, the negative effects are what? Trouble breathing?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Trouble breathing. A lot of it depends on the species. For instance, the shock organ of certain animals will differ, where in people you do worry about airway. In cats, you have to worry about their lungs as well. The dog shock organ is mainly their bowel and their liver. By that, I mean where blood will tend to pool and their blood pressure will lower as a result of that. But if you get an overwhelming allergic reaction, the upper airway is definitely a victim of that, where you will get swelling of the voice box or the larynx. And that, of course, is an immediate emergent situation.
We've talked before about snake bites, as I said earlier, and let's kind of go back to this territory because it's an important area to cover. And I should also, before we get into that, mention our telephone number is area code 352-392-8989 if you'd like to call into the program. Much the same way that an animal might encounter stinging insects, an animal might encounter out on a walk or maybe even around the home some sort of snake. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, there are a handful of venomous snakes in Florida. I couldn't name them all off the top of my head, but you may know mm-hmm. many of them. And then there are many non-venomous snakes that possibly, I mean, certainly they don't pose any risk to humans. The non-venomous snakes, though, that are not dangerous to humans, could they potentially be dangerous to our pets?
The non-venomous snakes that are non-venomous to humans will be non-venomous to our animals. So we don't worry about certain snakes such as the king snake, the rat snake, the black snake, the corn snake. Mm-hmm. They're all fairly benign and as compared to the vipers.
Yes.
That's the rattlesnakes, the water moccasins.
The non-venomous snakes then, the biggest risk is maybe what, just pain from a bite?
They won't even bite you.
Really?
The dogs will basically put them on the defense, and the snake might try to defend itself, but they don't have these long fangs that could penetrate the skin and cause that local damage that mm-hmm. some of the more venomous species can.
And the venomous snakes, we've got rattlesnakes, we've got moccasins.
Yes, right? We have, in this part of the state, Gainesville, we worry about the eastern diamondback rattlesnake, which is real bad. We have to worry about the water moccasin, which is our next baddie. And then we'll worry about the coral snake as well.
Right.
And a little further north, we might run into the timber rattlesnake. And then there's the canebrake rattlesnake more toward the panhandle region. And then there's the copperhead as well, which
yes.
is a little bit more north of us.
These snakes are certainly not out to do anybody harm, but you come up on a snake perhaps out on a trail, maybe if you have a lot of property, maybe out on your property. You or your pet comes up on one of these animals, and the animal is frightened. That is, the snake is frightened. It wants to kind of defend itself, particularly from something like a dog, which will be very curious mm-hmm. and want to interact with the snake.
Absolutely.
Right? Is that how it is? That how it plays out? You've probably talked a lot of times to pet owners who have brought in an animal that's been bitten. And is this what they tell you?
Exactly. The dog will go after the snake. That's where the dog becomes a predator and the snake is the victim.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely will you see the snake go after a dog, although there are snakes in certain parts of the world that will do that.
Yeah.
But in this part of the world, the snake would say, "Hey, leave me alone. I'll leave you alone. Don't bother me." But dogs will do it out of a sense of protecting the owner or protecting the property.
Mm-hmm.
and they just don't give it a second thought. That's their instinct.
Right. And therein is the risk, because the dog doesn't know it needs to be afraid.
Right.
And the snake is doing what it's naturally built to do, which is bite and inject venom. And then you've got a problem on your hands.
We do have a problem. We already saw two snake bites at the University Emergency Clinic over the past week.
Mm-hmm.
So the season is now opening. The snakes are coming out looking for mates. And during the mating season, they could be particularly aggressive.
Can you walk me through, not to kind of bring up what would be pretty traumatic to anybody who was in this situation. But for those who are listening to the program, you know, it might be helpful to know what is happening here. And somebody brings in a pet that they believe mm-hmm. or maybe even are sure has been bitten by a snake. It arrives at an emergency clinic. What happens then? Are you able to know what kind of snake it was? Because some people in the, the moment will not identify a snake.
Right. We'll find that the people out in the rural areas are more aware of the various types of snakes that live out there. The city folk, you're not going to have too much of a problem with snake bite. But the actual clinical signs are characteristic as to whether or not it's a pit viper or a coral snake.
Mm. Let's get back to that in just a moment, okay. Dr. Scheer. But first, let's go to the phones and talk to Kevin in Gainesville. Kevin, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Glad to.
What I've got he's a mix hound, maybe even mix boxer hound, and he's got what appears to be allergies from the grass in our yard. His stomach will become very red after laying in the yard, and his he'll get into his face and then start to get on the inner parts of his ears. I'm just curious. I don't exactly know what I should do about it.
That sounds like a great question, Kevin, because as I've spoken to one of Dr. Scheer's colleagues before, Dr. Oberkirchner, who deals a lot with, I think, allergies.
Dermatology.
This is something that can happen frequently.
Very common. We see allergies all over the country, basically. And in this part of the world, Florida is allergy haven because of all the vegetation. And dogs suffer just like people do. And the clinical signs, Kevin, that you described are very typical of a dog with a grass allergy. What can be done? We usually would recommend that a dermatologist be brought into the situation, because they might be able to do certain skin tests that can determine which particular grasses or molds might be the offending allergen, and they could make a serum that we can inject to hyposensitize or make them less allergic to eventually over a period of time. And sometimes this type of treatment will lessen the degree of the allergy. In some cases, it might make it go away altogether. It's kind of like a roll of the dice. You don't know what to expect until you try it. Otherwise, if you don't do anything like that, then you're stuck with symptomatic treatment with the use of various drugs like antihistamines and steroid drugs. And I do want to caution you that overuse of steroids in any animal can cause side effects that we try to avoid as much as possible. They are good for a very short-term period for symptomatic relief, but for long-term treatment, they could make animals suffer some considerable side effects.
I wonder, Dr. Scheer, with something like this in which the allergy seems to be brought on by skin contact with things out in the environment, short of, doing all of this stuff, would just in the meantime, washing your dog after every sort of outdoor adventure, is that a plausible kind of
Yes and no. You would remove some of the topical allergen. I got the same problem with my own dog. Mm-hmm. She walks out in the yard. Within 5 minutes, she's scratching. Okay, yeah. So common sense says, well, then don't let her out in the yard. Well, yeah. You know,
well,
let's be practical here. You know, the dog has to enjoy its environment. Or you could get rid of all the vegetation and replace it with concrete.
Well, that's not a good answer.
That would be the ideal world. But, you know, if they're not going to rub against the allergen, then they might actually inhale it and still get a skin reaction. So there's no escape from the environment unless you actually remove yourself from the environment.
But there are, for people like Kevin whose pets are experiencing this, there are solutions out there.
There are solutions where many of our practitioners might be able to do the skin testing and prepare the hyposensitization, where, on the other hand, if they don't have that level of experience, the university has its dermatology specialty, and I could guarantee you you'll get great service there.
Excellent. Let's go back to the phones and talk to Clarice. Hello, Clarice.
Hello, Jane. I just wanted to say, you know, I love your show, and, you know, if it weren't for your show, I probably wouldn't even wake up on Saturday morning.
I don't believe that, but how can we help you today?
Well, I heard that you said pets can be allergic to certain kinds of, you know, bugs and insects. Is there something you can use to protect them? Like, can you put bug spray on your dog?
That's a really interesting question. Thank you. You know, where I wonder if that would be most helpful is our pets outdoors get bitten by mosquitoes probably mm-hmm. a lot. And that poses a risk because mosquitoes carry what? The disease that causes heartworms?
They do. They do. And other diseases
and
as well.
And other diseases, of course.
Absolutely. Clarissa, that was a great question, and yes, there are products that are insect repellent. In action, one in particular is DEET, spelled D-E-E-T. What you have to be careful of when you use these products is that some animals might become sick from too much of the spray, and cats are particularly sensitive to these chemicals. Dogs are usually more tolerant, and my best advice is to discuss it with your veterinarian. They have the products, they have the knowledge as to how those products work, rather than walking into a store and buying it off the counter if nobody can give you proper advice about it.
And especially because, as we know, cats especially are fastidious groomers, and they lick their fur constantly.
That could be the problem. And the other thing is be careful of folklore as well, because I've even seen where people put kerosene and oil on their pets to try to repel insects. And we've had horrendous toxicities caused by that. So please, please, please do not do that.
Thank you so much for the call, Clarice. Let's go next to Jack in Gainesville. Jack, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Thank you so much. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Hi, Jack.
I have a question. I have a dog, and he's about 15 years old. And if he wants to get bit by something, I don't know, venomous snake, something that can cause him harm, would you suggest just letting the venom run its course since he is of old age, or would you suggest rushing to emergency to seek treatment?
Well, I would say this, Jack. What we're dealing with is an acute intoxicating event where, let's say, your 15-year-old dog would go merrily along to becoming 17 years old. And we want him to be healthy and free of pain and discomfort during that period. And especially with an acute situation such as a snake bite, granted they can be severely afflicted and some of them can even die because of it. But as a veterinarian, we like to treat for the treatable. We have the available means of doing that. And in most of our situations of snake bites and other venomous encounters, we're able to cure these animals. So I would say we advise the pet owner to go for it if it's within their means.
And in particular, Dr. Scher, it seems to me that not doing something would expose this animal to a great deal of discomfort.
Absolutely.
Right away. I mean, snake bites have got to hurt really bad.
And there is a lot of pain involved depending on the type of snake. And then there are other consequences such as uncontrollable bleeding and muscle damage, et cetera, that could result from the venom. So we can give them medications to help relieve the discomfort.
And, you know, of course, we hope in all cases, especially, you know, for Jack and his pet, that this doesn't ever come up. I mean, you know, just try and be really kind of aware of your surroundings, you know, and don't maybe let your pet get too far away from you.
Absolutely. Avoidance is the best policy. But sometimes, especially when you're on that rural fringe, nature comes right to the doorstep. Yeah. And it's unavoidable. Yeah. And it's up to the pet owner to know where they can receive emergency assistance as soon as possible.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's talk to Dave in Ridge Manor. Dave, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Good morning or afternoon.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Dave.
I wonder if I could ask two questions. One I need to know about a cataract problem, but the other is where I could find out if a service dog that's retired could still fly on an airline.
Oh, wow. I wouldn't even know where to find out about that.
Excuse me. I missed the last part of the
He asked how to find out if a service dog that had retired from actually being a service dog could fly on an aircraft, presumably in the cabin with the person.
Oh, that's a tough question. I would ask the airlines, basically. I would say if they're not active, then there might be less justification. But if they're wearing their yellow or green jackets and if they're still working to any degree, there's a good possibility that they might be able to come on board.
Can we get back to your first question, though, Dave? Can you remind us what it was again?
The cataracts. Well,
the cataracts.
He's about 14 and a half years old. And the cataracts are now so bad he can't really see much. Shadows is all which startled him. But I'm concerned about if he's, you know, going under a bush or something, if he's, you know, scratching his eyes. Should I maybe have him wear, like, dog goggles during certain times, or how to protect that from happening?
This is a very good question and probably a tough question because, you know, the eyes are a very sensitive part of the body. I wonder if there are any options. It sounds like Dave has an older animal. Are there options for treatment of cataracts?
Okay. Dave, that's an interesting question because we're dealing with a 14-year-old dog. And with the cataracts, we have to ask ourselves two other questions. Number one, is the back of the eye or the retina functional, like the film of the camera? Because if the lens isn't working because of the cataract, but the film is still functional, you could remove the cataract and then hope that vision will be restored. But if the eye itself is no longer working, then it doesn't pay to do the cataract removal. So the ophthalmologist or the eye specialist has a way of making that determination. And surgery is very available for patients with cataracts. And so long as they are healthy in other regards, such as kidney function, liver function, et cetera, we have trained professionals who can take care of that. Now, if the option for surgery is non-existent, then what about harm? Dogs are amazing animals with amazing instincts where they are quick to respond to something approaching their face. They have a very unique ability to close their eye rapidly. I've watched my own dogs do this, especially if they're outdoor dogs, such as a Labrador Retriever or a Golden Retriever. They know how to protect their eyes very, very quickly, as opposed to a dog such as a pug or the more bug-eyed dogs, the bulldog, etc. They're more susceptible to eye trauma because of the way the eye positions itself in the skull. So there are a lot of variables that go into this. But I would say in most situations, if your dog is familiar with his environment and he's lived there for a long time, he knows the dangerous places in the yard, and he will usually avoid those places. And they can be very remarkable in avoiding those types of circumstances.
Thank you very much for the call, Dave. I really appreciate it. Let's go, before we take a break, let's go to Mike in Gainesville. Mike, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Hi. I just wanted to suggest something for your consideration that may work with allergies in dogs. This is a solution that worked well for me. We travel back and forth to Ithaca, New York in the summertime and spend summertimes up there. And the place where we stay up there is in the middle of a field of goldenrod and many other very allergenic plants. And I came back to Gainesville one time, and I could not exhale at all through my nose. My allergies were so bad. And I saw Dr. Glowoski here, who's an ear, nose, and throat specialist, and she suggested... She said, you know, we can go to the allergist and do the serum and do all that. Or she said, next time you're up in Ithaca, buy some honey, which is produced up there as close to where you stay as possible and as close to the time of the year when you begin to have trouble as possible. And I and then when you're down in Florida and you're not being affected by the allergens, then take a teaspoonful of that honey every day. And you will be ingesting pollen from that area, and it's the same thing as the serum. Long story somewhat shorter, I did that, and it basically cured my allergies. And I don't have the allergies when I'm up there, and I don't have the allergies when I'm down here. It was very inexpensive.
Thank you very much for that call, Mike. You know what, I think one of the interesting things that Mike is bringing up is that here's a potential remedy that is relatively non-invasive, right? You're not adding drugs to your mm-hmm. system or anything like that. I mean, honey's about as natural as it gets. But what I wonder is, you know, a lot of the things that might work for a human being might not work as well for an animal, if that's the case. Or the variety of allergens that can affect our pets, you know, whether or not that would lend, they would lend themselves to treatment in this way.
There's a lot of variability with all this as far as the individual human being, the type of pollen that they're exposed to, and how their body responds to that. I listened with great interest, however, and I wrote this one down, and I'm going to remember it. Might even try it on myself. I would say I'm always open to new ideas, and a lot of my colleagues are as well. And Mike, I'm just going to thank you for your input on that, and we're going to think about that one for a while.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is area code 352-392-8989. We're going to take a short break, and we will be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM, our weekly hour-long call-in show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. My name is Dana Hill, talking today with our good friend Dr. Michael Scher from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. Our telephone number is area code 352-392-8989. Let's go back to the phones, Dr. Scher, and talk to Gene in Gainesville. Gene, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
The background, I have a 12-year-old beagle and a 2-year-old corgi, which they spend their days in the backyard and enclosed porch. But I catch them eating acorns and chewing on weeds, and the beagle in particular, maybe once a week, he'll have a upset stomach in the morning. You hear the churning, and I'm wondering if that's related or what I should try to avoid having them chew on.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, in the outdoors, they can, you know, even if it's a covered area, sometimes stuff gets in and they can get access to things.
They actually go out in the back fence yard and roam around and and it's landscaped.
Yeah. For the most part, I understand, Dr. Scher, dogs eat grass all the time.
They eat grass. They eat tree bark. They eat wood chips. I watch it every day myself. And most of the time, we'll have no consequences from this. If it does cause a little bit of a stomach upset, we might have a little vomiting or regurgitation, but nothing that I worry about. The one plant or the main plant that we do worry about in this part of the state is
sago palm.
The sago palm, yes. It's a very toxic plant, and it's an ornamental plant where it's on our neighbors' lawns oftentimes, so we do have to be careful about that. But if it's vegetation in your yard and you don't have that particular plant, then all the more power to our pets to go ahead and chew on many of these things without any consequences.
I mean, squirrels eat acorns all the time. Acorns have kind of a hard outer shell, and they got that weird yellow stuff in the middle. Could a dog even, like, digest an acorn?
Well, if they ingest it whole, mm-hmm. Now we're talking about the size of the animal versus the size of the acorn. But if you take a small animal and they swallow a large acorn, it is possible for them to get an intestinal obstruction. Mm-hmm. And then surgery has to be done to remove it. Mm-hmm. There have been those instances. And we could diagnose these on physical exam and using various imaging techniques.
But assuming then that Gene's dog is otherwise healthy, uses the bathroom like normal, then probably there's no major issue.
Exact. Most of the time, they'll chew on these things and be just fine without any problems.
Great. Thank you very much for the call, Gene. Let's go back just a little bit, Dr. Sharon. We were talking about some snake bites, and I was going to say that an animal comes into the emergency room. The pet owner has maybe not noticed exactly what snake mm-hmm. it was. In the emergency room, you have the ability to maybe make a determination as to what kind of snake it was based on the marks that it left or the where it bit, perhaps?
Generally speaking, yes. When we're talking about the pit vipers, we're talking about the eastern diamondback rattlesnake and the water moccasin. In this particular area, if the bite had not been witnessed and we have the dog coming in with clinical signs, it's going to be a toss-up as to whether or not it could be due to a water moccasin or an eastern diamondback rattlesnake. And sometimes the geographic whereabouts as to where the animal lives will help us hone in on a particular species that's more indigenous or more popular to that area. But there is a sequence of clinical signs that do occur, with the most common being is swelling at the site of the bite. It's a hemorrhagic kind of swelling, usually some bleeding from where the fangs penetrate the skin, and then the head starts to swell. And from there, depending on the amount of venom that gets into the animal, we'll start seeing the systemic signs, and that's where life-threatening situations start to occur.
This is likely to be a bite on the face or head.
And in the case of a dog, 70% of them do involve the face, but we do see bites to the limb. Cats usually get bitten on the trunk, and that's because of the way the cat stalks the snake versus the way the dog stalks the snake.
Yeah.
And then the cat starts doing a circle around it and then jumps in the air when the snake strikes, and they usually get nailed on the side of the trunk. But the dog oftentimes goes in head first, and that's why they get bitten in the face.
It is unlikely that a person would witness his or her cat out in the yard doing this. I mean, maybe you do, but likely you would try and interrupt this sort of encounter if you could. And I wonder, with particularly a cat and the wound on the trunk, you know, cats are pretty furry. You might not notice it right away, would you? Or would you notice the cat immediately behaving differently?
You will know within minutes in most cases.
Yeah.
The hemorrhage that occurs in the skin is quite obvious, and the patient will become very, very quiet.
Okay. Okay. So in that case, it is time to go into action.
Absolutely. You want to see an emergency clinic as soon as possible.
You know, along the sort of the same lines, people who live in the more rural parts of our listening area, even people actually who live in the city limits of Gainesville, will have wildlife in their yards. And this is something that could, I imagine, be potentially dangerous should an unfriendly encounter occur. I know that just on my own street, I have seen armadillos, which I assume are harmless to pets, raccoons, foxes. I've seen a fox in my neighborhood. I've also seen several different owls. Are any of these wild animals potentially dangerous to our pets?
The answer is definitely. And you might as well add coyotes to that list as well.
In Florida?
There are coyotes in Florida. And foxes and raccoons, you worry about rabies.
Okay.
Any rural, any wild animal, such as a carnivore, can carry that virus, and it's always something to worry about and to seek professional help if you yourself or your pet is bitten. Birds of prey, such as the owl, might be a threat to a small dog or a litter of puppies or a litter of kittens. If they're outside and exposed, those birds could swoop down and get a handful.
Yes. You know? I mean, we have red-tailed hawks.
Sure.
We have owls that live in my neighborhood for sure, I've seen. And probably even here on the University of Florida campus, I see birds of prey. And judging from what I've seen with their swooping down and grabbing a squirrel like it's no problem at all, of course. Another one, alligators. I mean, here on the University of Florida campus, you can't walk past a body of water without seeing an alligator. And many people who live in our community maybe live near retention ponds or streams or even lakes. And that is, of course, it's beautiful. If you can live out on Noonan's Lake or if you can live, say, out along near the prairie, that's a wonderful place to live. But alligators live in this environment too.
And gators love the taste of dogs.
This is
And gators will come out of the water to get a dog. My advice for any pet owner is to keep their dogs on a leash when they're near these bodies of water and to stay away from the shoreline, because we have an occasional case here and there that gets brought into the school. That's where we had an alligator attack. So don't try to second guess them, because they're very clever and they will pull the dog into the water if they can.
I would have figured, though, Dr. Scher, that any encounter really with an alligator for a small animal is going to be a fatal encounter.
That's going to depend on the owner. We had one situation a couple years ago where the owner actually went into the water after the gator and hit the gator in the head, punched him, and got the dog out of the out of the gator's mouth and ran to the shoreline, got the dog to the veterinary hospital.
If I could award a Pet Owner of the Year award on
this
show,
that was amazing.
That is the
that was amazing. Yeah. Some people might think it's insane, but when it's your own,
will it actually
go for it?
Truthfully,
you know?
It is risky for a human being to do something.
It definitely
like that.
Is
because on the land, you're pretty all right, but in the alligator's environment in the water, you're not as capable.
And the gator does not expect the human to go in and punch it.
No.
So you have the element of surprise as well.
True.
And it was a remarkable act of heroism. And the dog had a tremendously traumatized leg that took a long time to heal.
Mm-hmm. So the a pet owner who maybe is trying to keep his or her animal safe – we'll do the best to avoid these sort of situations, but, you know, maybe you have a dog or a cat that spends some time outdoors. You can't necessarily control whether or not raccoons or foxes get around. I mean, I've learned a bit about raccoons, and I've discovered that they can get anywhere they want to.
They're very clever, and living in this part of the country, this is all part of it, and there's risks living in any part of the country, big cities. You might worry about the human animal a little bit more. But in the country environment, this is what happens, and it's good to just know what's out there so you could take measures to try to avoid them.
Well, so a person might wonder, and by a person I mean me, whether or not you would know if your animal had an encounter with a perhaps a rabid raccoon or a fox or some other animal that could potentially do your animal harm, not necessarily just from the confrontation, right? I mean, if a raccoon bites your dog, it's probably not going to kill your dog just with the bite, but the disease that it might infect your dog with.
Well, there are very strict laws regarding the case of rabies anyway. That's why it's essential that every pet owner have their pets immunized for rabies. And the reason that the law is there is it's to protect the human who lives with that pet should that pet acquire the rabies. A lot of times if the animal is outside and there's an altercation with another animal, the pet owner might not see whether it's a wild animal or a domestic animal, but even a domestic animal can have rabies.
Right.
Horses could get rabies. So it's always important to keep the rabies immunization up to date. Then if we're dealing with an unknown or if we know that a fox or a raccoon bit your dog, then there's an extended period of quarantine mm-hmm. that we have to abide by in order to try to protect all of the family members who own that pet. And in some situations, they'll recommend that the pet be euthanized as well, especially if it's an unvaccinated pet,
right.
because they don't want to take the chance that the human might be subsequently exposed and come down with rabies. So this thing gets real complicated when you're talking about that particular disease. And there was just a case with an organ transplant this past week with somebody dying from a result of an organ transplant from a human donor who unknowingly acquired rabies. And the physicians who harvested the organs, they had no idea that there was a possible encounter. So subsequently, the organs that were harvested were used and given to the recipient. And there have been around 6 human deaths as a result of organ transplants containing the rabies virus.
Well, that's shocking.
Yeah.
So let us say then that an animal has had an encounter. You didn't witness it, you know, but your dog or your cat comes in and it's clearly had an encounter. You suspect maybe a raccoon. Do you, even if your animal has had vaccines, if it's had a rabies vaccine, which it should have, do you feel like, okay, well, you're in the clear? Or is there still a risk?
Well, if it were my dog, I would get a rabies booster mm-hmm. for that dog. And if it were to be possible to catch the raccoon or to catch the fox, you would hopefully be able to kill it, unfortunately. But that's the only way we can test their brain
mm-hmm.
and then know for sure whether or not the dog got bitten by a rabid animal or not. And when I make that statement, if somebody does have a weapon, such as a gun, if you're going to kill a raccoon or a fox because it bit your dog, try not to shoot it in the head because it's going to be harder to salvage the brain tissue that mm-hmm. way. So try to keep the head intact so that it's given to the public health intact and then they know what to do with it.
But for the most part, you know, are possums, raccoons, are they generally not high risk to our pets?
Possums are not a risk as far as rabies is concerned. Armadillos aren't at risk. But when you're talking about raccoons and foxes and bats, stray dogs, stray cats, even horses, we do worry about rabies.
We have a little bit of time left. Let's go back to the phones, Dr. Scheer. Let's talk to Mary in Williston. Mary, thanks for holding. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Hi. We just got our dog spayed, and she's about 2 years old. She was a rescue dog. And we got her stitches out yesterday, and it's weeping. And she jumped on my leg, and I had shorts on, and the fluid was a little brownish. And I was wondering if there was anything to be concerned with.
Okay. This could be relatively minor, although I hate to diagnose over the phone, so please accept it in that context. Sometimes it's just a little bit of an infection or irritation as a result of the suture itself.
Okay.
And what I would sometimes do with that is apply some warm applications, tap water to the area around twice a day for a couple days, and hope that it clears up. But if you're going to worry or if it looks more concerning, then definitely have your veterinarian take a look at it.
So giving her a bath is not a bad thing right now?
A bath wouldn't hurt her as long as she's acting normal in all other regards, and the area of the surgery looks intact and rather benign, then I would say you're okay.
Okie dokie.
Thank you very much for the call, Mary. I wonder, Dr. Scher, after our animals have surgery, should we be pretty gentle with those areas in which there's been an incision?
Absolutely. Surgery is trauma. And when you have traumatized skin, like any other part of the body, you want to rest it, take care of it, so that you don't add any insult to injury.
We have about a minute left, and before we go, another topic that's going to come up again very shortly that pet owners should be concerned about is the heat, right?
Yes.
It gets extremely hot in Florida, and our animals that are outside, you know, will try and find a shady spot to lie down. Sometimes they can't, and this is dangerous, right? And
absolutely.
And animals in cars is extremely dangerous.
Absolutely. Shade is essential. Cool water availability is essential. If the pets are going to be outside, never tie them to a shady part of the tree in the morning, because in the afternoon, sun might come out and hit that area and the animal's trapped. So be real, real careful about that and allow for protection. As far as the cars are concerned, it will take no more than 30 minutes in the month of July or August for the inside of your car to reach over 125 degrees Fahrenheit once you roll up those windows, and your animals will literally cook. So my advice is to definitely avoid leaving an animal in a hot car.
Dr. Scher, thank you so much for coming back and
You're
talking to
welcome.
Today. It's always
pleasure.
A pleasure.
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Michael Scher is from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. I want to say thank you to Luke Tia and Ben Wilson for running the program today. I appreciate it. Nancy Hamilton and Sarah Carey at the Vet College. I'm Dana Hill, back next week with another Animal Airwaves Live.